So today,
I want to talk a little bit more about what metta is, what metta does. Because it's very important that we understand what we're cultivating, that we not be confused about what we're doing here. And I want to begin by acknowledging that now, these days in the world, these are frightening times, sobering times. The level of suffering in the world and our collective exposure to it really do seem sometimes to be unprecedented. And if you read the headlines in 1 week, it can feel apocalyptic. Don't worry, nothing's happened out there. But sometimes if you read the news, it sounds like something is about to happen out there. And we deal with this in so many ways as individuals and collectively, ranging from avoidance to information addiction. And a lot of what we do is a response to the fear that this exposure engenders. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, "To many places, beings withdraw to escape from fear, to mountains, forests, parklands, and gardens, sacred places as well. But none of these places offer true refuge. None of them can free us from fear." So any external refuge is an illusory one. And the Buddha's antidote to fear, of course, was finding access to true refuge by training the mind, by purifying the mind. Through meditation and through ethical conduct. And we take this on as a practice to face what we fear. And I really love that book title by Pema Chodron, "The Wisdom of No Escape." When we know deeply that there's no external escape, we come to the practice with a kind of urgency. Right here is the refuge. As everything plays out in the conventional world around us. Because this practice offers us a place of internal safety, of being balanced in the here and now with what is, even if it's scary. And the irony of this being that the practice works only to the extent that we can come to grips inside with the very things that are propelling us to come to the practice in the first place, these very things that we're afraid of on the outside. We have to face them on the inside to find that refuge. If we want to be free from fear, we have to face fear, to accept it, to know it as it is. Likewise, for any mind state that we want to be free of, anger, greed, and so on through the entire range of painful human experience. The Buddha understood this really deeply and emphasized its importance in his very first teaching, that teaching of the Four Noble Truths. There is dukkha, which is suffering, unreliability, unsatisfactoriness, and so on. And it must be understood. And I know on some level we all understand this. I mean, really, this is basic dharma. But very practically, we can find ourselves doing everything in our power to bypass suffering, to dismiss suffering, to put it kind of somewhere where we can't see it. And I may not be alone in this, but I know for myself, this is one of the most challenging aspects of the practice, whether it be this metta practice or vipassana practice. Is simply facing what is in there to be faced. Fortunately, in Buddhism, we do not have original sin. We just have causes and conditions and karma. It's actually a great relief. It's very impersonal. On the other hand, what that means is there's no one to save us from ourselves and our habits. We alone are responsible for waking up. There's no salvation by a higher power. There's no guru who can take our karma from us. So our flaws, our pain, our bad habits, the things we wish we could overcome, these are the very places of our metta practice. One of my first teachers, Manindraji, used to say a lot, actually, he'd repeat it a lot. The Buddha solved his problem, now you have to solve yours. Gulp. You know, it's like, oh, okay. And that gulp is because it's, of course, it's not easy. It takes patience, humility, deep honesty. Because the birth of any kind of suffering never lies in the object that we're reacting to. It's in the mind and heart that suffering takes birth. So it's never anything external, never anything out there that seems to be actively driving us crazy, whether it be another yogi who might breathe a little funny or walk too loudly, whether it's the ticking clock, whether it's the lights at night, whether it's the trash, whatever it is, that's not the problem. Ajahn Chah had a great line about sound. He said, you know, sound is just doing its thing. It's just being sound. Don't you go out and bother it. So the practice gives us the means to work with all of this stuff that comes up. But it isn't anesthesia. It's actually quite the opposite. We have to dive in. We have to take stock and come to an honest and clear understanding of where we are, here and now, warts and all. There's a poem I really, really like by a 14th century Japanese poetess named Izumi Shikubu. And she had a really complicated life and a deep one. She says, watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky. I knew myself completely, no part left out. It helps to know about this poem that the Zen metaphor for complete and awakening is the full moon. So watching the moon at dawn, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. And when we read this, we think, oh, enlightenment. It took me some time to get this, because when the moon is at zenith at dawn, it's not a full moon, it's a half moon. This is her way of saying, I'm not asleep, but I'm not awake. And I can accept whatever is arising completely. This is the doorway in. To know ourselves completely really takes more than the development of wisdom or clear seeing. And this is where the metta is absolutely essential, because it's metta that allows us to deeply connect with the most flawed parts of our psyche and of our conditioning, without flinching, without turning away, without trying to avoid or deny. And with the deepening of metta, we can see ourselves and others completely and whole, including both the good and the not so good. And we don't resist whatever we see. So the classical definition of metta in the texts, emphasizing this, and characterizes metta as having, quote, a mode or manner of friendliness, close quotes. And when you think about it, friendliness is really by nature kind, interested, responsive. If we're friendly to others, we're open, we're approachable. And if we're friendly to ourselves, there isn't any harsh judgment. There isn't any attempt to be perfect or somehow better than we are right now. And towards others and towards ourselves, there's acceptance and respect. This respect is really, really important. Somebody was mentioning in their interview this morning something quite beautiful that had happened to them in the practice with respect to a family member who, there had been some difficulty with this person, but what was growing was this beautiful respect. And that is metta, that respect. And to clarify here, and this is really important to understand, metta is not concentration. These are two very different mind states, mental factors. And they're interacting, but they're separate. So there is the concentration on one hand, and there is the metta on the other. And by doing this systematic cultivation of loving kindness, concentration will arise. But they're not the same thing. So please don't confuse the two. The metta is the friendliness, the well-wishing, the benevolence, this characteristic of respect. And the concentration is the one-pointedness, the connecting and sustaining that connection with the phrases, with the meaning. And the mind that sticks to that and doesn't waver. So metta as friendliness of respect, it's a mind and heart state that's actually much, much more subtle than an experience or than any emotional expression of that friendliness or that respect or that openness of heart. It's simply that benevolence, that inclusive well-wishing. Metta also does not idealize and then judge ourselves or other people. It's really, really very realistic. So there's the understanding that we're doing the best we can, but that we're not perfect. So when we live in an internal world of shoulds and shouldn'ts, this isn't metta, it's judgment. Or if we create kind of a dharmic veneer over the way we actually are, oh yes, this is happening, but I'm fine with that. Maybe. This isn't metta either. It's spiritual bypassing. Metta abides with whatever is, with that openness and that non-judgment. In the Metta Sutta at the very beginning, you've probably noticed as we chant this, there's a whole series of mind states, heart states, actions that the Buddha gives that says, if you want to be happy, here's how to go about doing it. And one of those 15 things in that list is to be honest with ourselves and others. So the Pali is ujucha, sujucha. He isn't just saying you have to be honest. He's saying to be straight, very straight. He says it twice like that, emphasizing the importance of honesty internally and externally. So the metta practice asks that we not be fake. No fake internal news. We can't have pretensions. So meeting ourselves completely, as that verse says, no part left out, is really where the metta practice begins, where it flourishes, and where it comes to fulfillment. And the natural function of metta, what it does, is to promote this kind of friendliness, to encourage that open-heartedness towards ourselves and each other. It actually guides the heart towards being willing to see imperfections and personal traits as people, not as things that need to be changed so that they or it no longer bothers us here in the center of the universe. But metta has that wisdom embedded in it that understands that the source of suffering is greed, aversion, and delusion. And these things are common human experiences rather than personal failings. So inside as well as outside, towards oneself as well as towards others. This is the limitlessness of metta that we've been talking about. And some of you have mentioned in your interviews an experience of evenness. And this is very much the expression of that limitlessness, where the metta encounters no barriers between the dear friends, the various dear friends you've been working with, and the respected person. The metta itself feels very much the same. This is an expression of that limitlessness. In the texts, it gives a particularly gruesome metaphor for this. And it's imagining yourself at a crossroads with, in the company of, your benefactor, your dear friend, a neutral person, and an enemy. And you're on a walking journey, and some bandits come to you, and they overpower your little group, and they say to you, you're the leader, and they say to you, okay, you have to choose. We need one of you for a sacrifice, a blood sacrifice. You choose. So do you say, oh, okay, I'll go and, you know, sacrifice myself for the benefit of everybody else? Or do you say, well, my enemy over there, the world will be a much better place if he's not there, so he can go. Or is it the neutral person? It's like, well, I don't really know that person, so it won't bother me so much. But not my dear friend, not my benefactor. And it says in this metaphor, it says, when metta is perfected, you can't choose. They're all the same. All the barriers that we have in the heart towards these different categories are gone. Just as I want to be happy, so may you be happy. And we begin to feel that if somebody else has something and they're happy, this is us. There's no separation. There's no difference. But of course, we don't start here. We start with those barriers. And the barriers we build in the heart are constructed by the ego that Ariya was talking about the other day. And in the outer world, we create barriers to protect what is ours and to exclude whomever we don't like or fear. The more fear we have of loss or intrusion, the higher the walls get, right? You see this here in Burma a lot. You see these huge walls with razor wire over the top. But the thing about these walls is they imprison as much as they protect. So what kind of walls do we have inside? What kind of false places of safety are we creating inside that imprison us? Because if we live in an inner fortress of preferences and judgments. Nothing of the wider world can reach us. It's really a form of solitary confinement. And this is what gets broken down in the metta practice. These judgments, these preferences. So with metta, we cannot any longer dismiss other people because they act out of bad habits, or maybe they have unpleasant personality traits. We can't deem them as unworthy of kindness, of respect. And we can't dismiss parts of ourselves inside as unworthy of kindness. It's that no parts left out aspect of metta. It's that aspect of loving kindness practice that's a training and purification here, so that a friendly attitude and basic well-wishing is the default setting for all beings. I came across a really beautiful little book this last year by a man named Mohammed El-Bachiri, and it's called A Jihad for Love. This is a young man who's Belgian, of Moroccan extraction. He's a subway driver in Belgium. And he lost his wife and the mother of his children in the bombings that happened. And it's a small book that's basically a eulogy for his wife and his reflections about love and about the importance of not reacting out of fear and out of hatred, no matter what. And he says, "The heart of every person is big enough to include all mankind. All we have to do is open it without fear." The heart of every person is big enough to include all mankind, and all we have to do is open it without fear. I like the way he puts it. All we have to do, right? As if it's easy. But of course, this doesn't happen immediately or all at once. And this is what can make the metta practice such a challenge. It's a purification, as I mentioned the other day, and it's a training. So it requires patience, persistence, and humility. And that kind of courageous honesty that the Buddha asks of us. Because we know our ideals, we know what we want to be, we know what we'd like to be. And if we're courageous enough to be really honest with ourselves, we can see the distance between ourselves and that ideal. And if we have the courage to really meet this, to open the heart to this, this is what allows acceptance and metta to flow. so that we meet ourselves and each other as we really are. And we can face the kilesa that arise honestly and without wavering. To face that greed, that hatred, the delusion, without fear or resistance in ourselves and in other people. The essence of the metta practice, as Arya was saying the other day, is the generation of a new habit of heart, creating a new habit of heart, so that when things get difficult, when unpleasant things arise, metta becomes the default setting, rather than any unwholesome habitual mind states of greed, irritation, doubt, what have you. From the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha says, whatever a bhikkhu, a monk, and that of course means a meditator as well, whatever a bhikkhu thinks about and frequently ponders upon, that becomes the inclination of his mind. That's what we're doing here, isn't it? We keep inclining to the loving kindness over and over and over again. So by inclining to the wholesome, loving kindness, in this case, and doing that repeatedly, we create that new default setting. We create that new habit pattern. Maybe it isn't here now. But if we keep patiently at it, over and over and over again, the habit will become firmly established in the future. In the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha says, in a sutta called the Removal of Distracting Thoughts, the Vitakka Santana Sutta, he says, he speaks of different ways to work with persistent patterns of thinking in the meditation practice. And he describes different tactics to use when we're faced with unwholesome thought patterns. And the very first of these tactics, these ways of working with unwholesome thought, is exactly what we're doing in the metta practice. I'm going to read directly from the sutta. He says, here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some object, and owing to that object, there arise in him unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, or with delusion, then he should give attention to some other object connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to this other object connected with what is wholesome, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hatred, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse pig by means of a fine one, so too, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu gives attention to this other object connected with what is wholesome, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. So we replace by repeated inclination what is unwholesome with what is wholesome. This is why sometimes when Saito gives instructions, he says, reflect upon the dangers of anger. This helps us disengage from what is unwholesome when we know what it does to us, when we know what it does to other people. So very practically, though, what do we do when we do this? What do we do when we're beset by doubt or dosa or greed? First, of course, is to briefly, and I emphasize briefly, acknowledge whatever it is. Not going into it in a vipassana way, but just simply recognizing presence. Dosa is here. Doubt is here. Greed is here. Distraction, whatever it is. Just to recognize that it's there and acknowledge that. It's that honesty. Then there's a choice point. We choose in this practice not to feed it, to put it to the side. And of course, often when something is happening, we're already feeding it. We've begun to feed it already. But the moment we recognize that this is happening, this is the place where we can actually, sometimes even physically, stop. For example, if it's happening in the walking practice, just stop. Pause. And really firmly but gently take the mind by the hand and begin again with the cultivation of loving kindness. By repeating the phrase, connecting with the meaning, connecting with the person for whom you're radiating loving kindness, and repeatedly planting that seed. And with these unwholesome mind states, we don't go into them. We don't investigate them in this practice. We don't try to understand them. Sure, it's hard. I fully know this from my own practice. This stuff has this really, really strong gravitational field. And it can be very hard to stop. It can be very hard to kind of, no, let's go over here. Because the kilesa come from the ego, and the ego is a bully. So this will necessarily take a certain amount of determination and a certain amount of effort. And of course, there is that willingness to feel whatever it is. This in itself is kaya kama metta, action coming out of metta. Turning towards it, stopping, doing something different. So internally in the mind, letting whatever it is be in the background, and actively but gently and persistently continuing to do that reinclination. And it helps to really bring some lightness in here, particularly with really difficult mind states. The metaphor I like for myself is of a very small child in the grocery store wanting something. Mommy, I want the chocolate. No. Mommy, you know. The kid in the store wants junk, and the mother says no. And of course, then there's a meltdown. But what we're doing with the metta practice is distracting that kid with higher goodies, wholesome goodies, the metta, as opposed to the unwholesome mind states. So if you are experiencing an inner tantrum and you need to cultivate metta for yourself, do that. And it's just, yes, and all of this is arising. Yes, and may I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway. It just is this very gentle and tender embrace, acknowledging what is and feeding something else. And here, with this aspect of the practice, mindfulness, sati, is really essential. That's what allows us to stop. So it helps not to be speeding around in our outer aspect, in our walking, in our actions and movements. It gives more space to stop, to realize we're caught somewhere. And moving gently is also a form of metta that really, really helps this whole process. I don't know if any of you have also noticed this, but Aria and I certainly have. In the evening, after the chanting, Saito walks in here. He comes through the door. He doesn't fly in. He comes in the door just like all of us do. He sits down in his chair, and he doesn't make a sound. We're trying to figure out how he does that, because the floor creaks, even if you walk very carefully. But, yeah, this care is also metta. So to bring this also into bodily action, not in a vipassana way, but just as a way of taking care of ourselves and taking care of each other. So when we guide the mind repeatedly in this way towards friendliness, no matter what, it doesn't mean we create a situation where all our bad habits are going to take over. That's the fear, right? If I let this be here, it's just going to take over. But really, if we're practicing in this way, it doesn't. It just gives it the space to be there and be known. And it gives us the awareness to make a choice and to go towards the loving kindness. And this acceptance and this caring interest, it's really the only way to gain a balanced and skillful attitude towards these things. It's the friendliness of metta that leads the mind to a place where there's an attitude of acceptance about all our imperfections. And it's only through that kind of interest that understanding and true wisdom can arise. So whether we're dealing with our inner habit patterns or with pain on account of the outer world and the chaos of the outer world, it's very helpful to remember that metta was offered by the Buddha as a direct antidote to fear. And fear is often under a lot of unskillful habits. I don't know if any of you have noticed about anger. Anger often arises out of fear of something or another. And this is easy to see in certain situations. For example, if you're driving and somebody cuts in front of you and nearly hits you, the first response is to, you know, do something with one of your hands to let that person know exactly what you think of them. It's anger. It's like, you stupid, you know, whatever. But then when you touch in what's under that, there's this shakiness of, oh my God, I almost got hit. Under that, driving that anger, is fear. Likewise, lots of things in our lives. Procrastination is another thing. We fear we're not going to do it right, so, well, why do it at all? Put it off. But the Buddha was very, very, very clear. He offered this sutta to a group of monks who were beset by fear. And he said, this is your practice and your protection. And if we keep just patiently doing this practice, when the metta gets strong, fear is banished. And once we're no longer afraid, we have that refuge that the Buddha was talking about in that Dhammapada verse. No matter what happens out there, we have an inner refuge of fearlessness. So in this world, right now, we all urgently need to cultivate this loving kindness for ourselves and for the benefit of all beings. And even small amounts can have great benefits. So please don't think, oh, well, yeah, but this isn't enough, what I'm doing. This isn't in some way good enough. So I want to close with a verse from the Anguttara Nikaya. The Buddha says, if with a mind free from hate, one arouses loving kindness toward just one being, one thereby becomes good. Compassionate in mind towards all beings, a noble one generates immense merit. Bhikkhus, if a bhikkhu cultivates loving kindness only for as long as a finger snap, he is called a bhikkhu who has carried out the master's teaching. So how much more could be said of those who make much of it? So if you cultivate loving kindness just for that one moment, you've carried out the Buddha's instructions. How much more could be said of doing what you're doing? Because all of you, every single person in this room, has made much of it. Has created a lot of this loving kindness. So how much more could be said of that? I leave you to find the answer to that question for yourselves. And really sincerely and just profound thank you for your practice. This is the best and the most important thing we could be doing in this world now and in these times. So thank you. Thank you. And may this repeated inclination of the heart to loving kindness become an unshakable refuge, an unshakable habit, both now internally in this retreat and in your outer lives.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.